Hello, fellow realists. I'm David Ravel, and this is ValueSide Weekend for May 21st and 2nd. For all of our articles and podcasts, visit valueside.com. Well, today, two Fed hikes and a bear market. Well, earlier this year, the Federal Reserve began talking about raising interest rates. For the 2 years since the beginning of the pandemic, rates have been held at virtually zero. And it became clear that Jerome Powell and the rest of the members of the Fed were serious about rate hikes. First in March, then again in May, the Fed has hiked twice, the second time bringing short-term rates to a range of 75 to 100 basis points, with promises of many more hikes throughout the year. Well, here we are, with one of the most dramatic sell-offs in stocks in recent memory. In just 2 months, the Dow is down 13%, Standard & Poor's 500 down 20%, and the NASDAQ down an incredible 25%, due primarily to declines in the market-leading FANG stocks, Facebook, Apple, Amazon, Netflix, Microsoft, and Alphabet Google. The current loss on these six stocks alone is estimated to be well over $2 trillion. So as we try to sort through all of this, let's take a step back and look at the week just passed. In the gentleman's duel that was popular around the time this nation was founded, like the one that took Alexander Hamilton's life, the opponents were given a single-shot pistol. March 10 paces went the instructions, turn and fire. It must have been a wild event, for the contestants had to turn quickly, gain their target, aim, and fire. And there was one thing you knew for certain. If you fired and missed, then you were as good as dead, because your opponent would almost certainly reach his target. Today, this country finds itself in the modern equivalent of that ancient combat. And it is the United States, as the aggrieved party, which has selected the method of conflict. The conflict will be economic, declared President Biden, as he imposed sanctions against Russian oil and gas sales here in the United States, a move which in and of itself removed approximately 10% of our daily use of petroleum, and especially refined gasoline. Biden imposed sanctions on major Russian banks, including VTB Bank, Novacom Bank, Sovacom Bank, among several others, essentially removing these banks from the U.S. dollar-denominated SWIFT international transfer system. And the U.S. led additional sanctions against selected Russian individuals, including Vladimir Putin and several leading businessmen. Now, the president described these sanctions as severe and far-reaching, designed to cut off the main artery of the Russian economy. His statement back in February read, quote, "We have purposely designed these sanctions to maximize the long-term impact on Russia and to minimize the impact on the United States and our allies. I want to be clear, the United States is not doing this alone. For months, we've been building a coalition of partners representing well over half of the global economy." Unquote, Joe Biden. In short, the United States had fired its round. In economic terms, there would seem to be little more that the U.S. could add to its economic attack on Russia. However, Russia has yet to respond. Now, to be fair, there have been some minor reverse sanctions by Russia, as when they proclaimed sanctions against President Biden himself, Secretary of Defense Austin, and Joint Chiefs Head Miley. But on the balance, Russia has imposed nowhere near the type of across-the-board, core economic shots that they are more than capable of. Instead, Russia has been able to parry the U.S. thrusts and turn them to its own advantage. Case in point, our move to remove Russia from SWIFT. It was countered with Russia requiring oil and gas payments only in rubles, thereby strengthening their own currency. Additionally, it appears that Russia has been able to simply replace other international transactions with the Chinese competitor of U.S. SWIFT called SIPS. Refusing all U.S. deliveries of Russian oil and gas has driven up the price of domestic gas here at home, while Russia has been able to find other buyers principally in India and other Middle Eastern countries. But note, these have all been Russian counters to the U.S. sanctions. Russia has yet to fire its economic cannon towards the U.S., and it's here that things could really get dicey. Now, this weekend we saw perhaps the Russian counter-economic offensive begin when they cut off Finland's electricity, after that country indicated a desire to join NATO. But Finland may be only the beginning of what Russia has in store. With Russia's control over Ukraine, they are now the most influential exporter of wheat and grains in the world. They've not yet indicated that they will play the wheat card, but it's certainly a possibility. Oil, too, is a powerful weapon that Russia still has at its disposal. We've seen this as we've watched many of the European countries concede to paying for their oil in rubles. Now, Russia is a country with but half the population of the United States and an economy that is only a fraction as large. But it is proven to have a seasoned and wily leader willing to take chances and strategically playing his hand. Remember, we've already played ours. In economic terms, it's Vladimir Putin who has the loaded pistol. It's his turn to take his shot. We hear it all the time. Sorry, that item is out of stock. We see that everywhere we go. More and more, as I shop, I see this or that item no longer currently available. And many times, the store doesn't know just when it will come back. Shortages. They've become the watchword of modern America. We might want to purchase an item or a good, and yet more often than not, the store or online shopping site just can't get it. Economists glibly tell us that it's the supply chain, don't you know? Okay, I understand. That gives me some vague idea that the things I want are parked on a boat or in a plant over in China. But let's delve a little deeper here. Let's get to the heart of what is really happening. We begin with the little-noticed economic report, which will be released in just a few minutes. This morning at precisely 9:15 Eastern Time, the Federal Reserve will let us know that the manufacturing in this country is going down the drain. They won't put it that way exactly. But translated, that's what they'll be saying, as they've been saying that for the last 35 years. The Federal Reserve will report, once again, that less than 79% of our manufacturing plants are currently at work. That means, of course, that fully 21% of the plants are idle, not working at all, available, but not needed. And as I say, this is a trend, a very long-term trend. It's something that I cannot say enough. In a well-balanced, fully functional economy, production and consumption would be balanced, 50-50. The economy would produce just the amount that the consumers wanted to purchase. But the United States is nowhere near a well-balanced economy. We produce less than two-thirds of what our consumers want to purchase. That means that consumers must look elsewhere for more than a third of what they want to purchase. Hence those out-of-stock signs at the local merchandise store. For many of us, this is something that has just begun to appear in the last year or so. But I want to take you back to the year 1995. It was in that year, specifically, that China was introduced into the World Trade Organization, giving China preferred status as a full member nation of the WTO. Up until that point, China had limited access to the United States markets. And many up until that point did not want China to join the WTO, pointing to China's dismal record in terms of pollution and human rights violations. Those alone should have prevented China's acceptance into the WTO. President Bill Clinton, however, thought otherwise. Putting the full prestige and influence of his office on the line, Clinton proposed that China indeed should be admitted. Quote, "By joining the WTO, China is not simply agreeing to import more of our products, it is agreeing to import one of democracy's most cherished values, economic freedom." Well, Of course, the reality has been that while China has imported some American products, America has been the one that has imported multiple times more Chinese products than they've ever sold to us. In 1995, when the U.S. Senate finally agreed to full trading status with China, our overall goods trade deficit was just $9 billion. Last year, that ballooned to $109 billion. Now, granted, the trade deficit includes all countries and not just China, but the trend for China has been just about the same. Since 1995, our idled manufacturing capacity in the U.S. has nearly doubled, until today, as we stated, over one-fifth of our plants are idle. As for those other concerns about China, human rights, environmental pollution, and as Clinton touted, economic freedom, none have seemed to improve over these last 35 years. But past diplomatic mistakes need not be the end of our story. Today we have those self-same manufacturing plants standing by, unused, ready to begin the production that American consumers are anxious to purchase. Within a half an hour drive from where I live, sit factories ready to be brought back to life, workers and modern equipment put into place. Remember, by and large, it was American capital and technology that built those Chinese factories. Why not do the same back here in the USA? Feel like spring around here. Time to get out, maybe take a little drive, see the country. At least that's how I felt before I took the family car over to the gas station. At $4.25 a gallon, gas here in Pennsylvania is double what it was just a couple of years ago. So it's costing me about $50 to fill up the tank in the small car, and I haven't dared filled up the truck yet. Now, in just a few minutes, the Energy Information Agency, the EIA, will give a whole raft of reports on this week's oil production and all the various oil products, from gasoline to heating oil, jet fuel, and diesel. And as you are no doubt aware, the news about gas and oil prices isn't looking good as we go forward here. Aside from the dramatic hike in gasoline prices that we're all experiencing, there's the recurring rumor that we're running out of diesel here on the East Coast. That rumor, incidentally, is true. And the apparent fact that there doesn't seem to be any relief in sight. So here are four quick facts to keep in mind next time you're filling up. Fact number one, the U.S. is not producing as much oil as it did before the pandemic. In March of 2020, the month the pandemic first hit, U.S. oil production hit an all-time record high of 13,000 barrels of oil a day. The pandemic immediately dropped our production by 25%, and U.S. oil production has recovered, but only partly. Current production levels are still about 2,000 barrels a day below that 2020 record. Fact number two. We only have one-half the refinery capability that we had before 2015. A series of accidents and environmental issues have closed half the refineries up here in the Northeast, including Philadelphia's main refinery, which had been in operation since 1870. This lack of refinery means that even if we were producing enough oil, we couldn't refine it and bring it to market. Fact number three. In reaction to the Ukraine incursion by Russia, the U.S. blocked all Russian imports of oil. This effectively cut off 10% of our supply. Supply, incidentally, which was not entirely replaced by the president's release of gas from our strategic reserves, a release which is scheduled to end in less than 6 months. Fact number four. The president has halted all further oil exploration on federal lease lands, representing a majority of all proven reserves in the country. Most recently, you'll recall, President Biden vetoed new oil leases on the North Slope of Alaska and in the Gulf of Mexico last week. Now, among the many reports that the EIA will release will be a report entitled Gasoline Stocks Change. This report tells us just how much gasoline the nation has on hand currently. And for the 7th week in a row, and the 11th week out of the past 13, Wall Street expects that today's report will show that we have less gas on hand this week than we did last week. Of course, reduced supplies result in higher prices, and that's just what we're experiencing. Now, for all of us, it's fair warning that things are going to get a little tight around here as the summer unfolds. America seems destined to underestimate Russia. It was 65 years ago when Russia first surprised the United States. We had just emerged from World War II a dozen years before, and here in this country, it was a time of unrivaled prosperity, a time with mom and pop and all the kids, when America was second to none. After all, it was America that won the war, and that's exactly how we felt. And then it happened. Russia, that faraway place, so beaten down by the war, sent a satellite directly over America. How could that be? America was preeminent in all science and technology. We had the finest scientists, quite a few who were German as it turned out, the best research laboratories, and the wealth to put it all together. And yet here Russia. Russia with seemingly none of those advantages had beaten us into space. As a young boy at the time, I still to this day remember the impact that this event had on the American psyche. People rushing out into the yards to watch it go overhead, just a small dot in the evening sky, but many were genuinely frightened, afraid that a bomb or other device might rain down on them. And although the true technology behind all this was really primitive, it marked an epic change in our history, as the Cold War became absolutely frigid. Years have passed. There are fewer of us who remember that Russian triumph, but I remember those days when I watched this week as Russia again triumphed, on the battlefield and in the boardroom. This was the week that Mariupol fell, the last major strategic goal of Russia's initial game plan to intervene in Ukraine. An important seaport, Mariupol was also the base of some of Ukraine's fiercest soldiers, the Azov Battalion, and although the battle was long and bloody, in the end, it was Russia who was victorious. But Russia's battles were not just in Ukraine. They extended to the international capitals of commerce and banking. The first shots in this battle were fired by the United States as we slapped severe sanctions on Russia and prevented Russia from using the most widely used method of international financial transactions, the SWIFT system. Russia, which incidentally is the world's third largest oil producer, behind only the U.S. and Saudi Arabia, Russia then responded to those sanctions by requiring payment for their oil in Russian rubles. And one by one, Russia has seen the European energy companies and utilities agree to meet Russian requirements. Most have opened accounts now with Gazprom Bank, the giant financial agent for the Russian oil company. Gazprom Bank accepts payment in euros and then immediately converts those euros into rubles, thus pleasing both parties. Last night, when the European Union once again asked for additional sanctions against Russia, they failed. As most utilities and energy companies, and also Hungary, would not go along. Now, capping off this incredible week for the Russians, came word last night that their economy grew by 3.2% in the first quarter of this year, the second fastest growth in the G20. The G20 is, of course, the largest economies in the world. If what we're seeing currently is a proxy war in Ukraine between Russia and the United States, as President Biden has implied, then it seems, so far at least, the momentum is clearly on Moscow's side. It reminds me of a time many, many years ago, when a small silver sphere forever etched its memory in the American mind. Well, an interesting report hit my desk yesterday entitled Canada Raw Material Prices. Now, if there's one place on earth that doesn't need raw materials, I thought, it's Canada. Do these people know anything about Canada? It's the world's second largest country, bounded by the United States on the south and three oceans, the Pacific, Atlantic, and Arctic oceans above it. Vast does not begin to describe Canada, with forests that stretch from here to forever, one of the largest oil reserves on Earth, and a leader in just about every industrial metal you'd care to name, from zinc to iron to uranium. Canada has it all. Well, it turned out that the report was from the Statistics of Canada, an agency of their government, so I guess they did know a thing or two about the country. My bad. But how is this possible? How is it that Canada, of all places, has to first import raw materials, and second, that it has to pay such an incredibly high price for those materials? Well, the second question is easier to answer than the first, so let me give you that. In the past 12 months alone, Canada's price for raw materials is up over 38%, and that's what really drew my eye. Worst still, Canada Statistics is cheering the fact that this latest month represents a reduction from the over 42% higher prices they were running the month before. And it was at this point that the light began to dawn. Why, these prices represent not just the prices of raw materials produced in Canada, but also the materials not produced in Canada, imported in other words. And it's here that things get a little tricky. So what if a foreign-owned company produces raw materials in Canada and then turns around and sells those products back to, say, a Canadian manufacturer? Are those foreign raw material sales or domestic? And it's not just an idle question. You see, traditionally, both the United States and Great Britain have invested heavily in Canada, with many American cars, for instance, produced up north. But recently, a third party has elected to join in, and that party is China. And China has a seemingly inexhaustible appetite for especially Canadian resource companies. For the past 20 years, China has bought as many small Canadian gold mines as they could get their hands on, also lumber companies, but most especially Canadian oil companies. In the past few years, China has purchased ADAX Petroleum, Petro-Kazakhstan, and CNOOC Petroleum, all major Canadian producers. So now we come to the question. If a Chinese oil company produces oil in Canada, is it foreign oil? The answer, I'm quite sure, is yes. China owned that oil and sold it back to Canada, so it's foreign oil. But the greater question, and the more important one, is who sets the price? And here, there can be absolutely no doubt. China, or at least those Chinese companies, set the prices. And when that salient point is fully grasped, you then understand why prices for raw materials in Canada have risen so much. It's not where those raw materials are located that counts, it's who sets the price. Yes, you can still sell ice cubes to Eskimos if you own the ice maker. And that's the Value Side Weekend. As we take this break, let's hope for a better week ahead. For all of our podcasts and blog posts, visit valueside.com. I'm David Revelle. Value Side is independently written and researched. The views expressed are strictly my own.